Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Reich on a rainy day here in Illinois. Today we got a very, very special guest, Professor Dr. Mohammed Meraki. He's going to talk about Afghanistan and everything. This gentleman is incredible. His family history is staggering. Mohammed Meraki, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. You and I have known each other for quite a few years, and
yes, indeed.
I'm not even sure how we got connected, but I tell you, it was definitely a blessing that you and I met.
Yeah, very kind. Actually, we were discussing the depleted uranium issue and the use and how they use it and how they the consequences on that on the civilian population and so forth.
Yeah,
that's how we met. Yeah.
Devastating. I mean, your family history is so tied together with Afghanistan, so, I mean, you know the inside and outside of what's happened, don't you?
Yes, yes. I'm quite well-versed in the situation that happened from the beginning and how things turned up, turned down and up and the way they are today. And it, you know, it has historical basis, of course, The relatively recent history was, of course, September 11, when followed by the invasion of Afghanistan. But the problem that I usually have, and I tend to question that there were no basis, evidence, if you will, of who was behind September 11's attacks, and Afghanistan had nothing to do with it, and those people involved, were, if those people are indeed who they were not even Afghans. But anyway, the cost of the invasion, of course, been, you know, around 1 million people killed in Afghanistan, and it has sustained a corrupt administration that's been involved in drug trafficking and all type of corrupt practices. And NGOs that have swindled money left and right, and the common people in Afghanistan have basically continued to live in abject poverty. And essentially, what, you know, usually people tend to be quite opinionated in regards to the Taliban being this, Taliban being, all type of negative connotations to them, but they need to also understand that after 1992, when the communist regime fell and these Northern Alliance individuals came into being and took over the government, Afghanistan turned into fiefdoms, basically, small principalities, and these warlords were practicing really heinous crimes, and thousands of people perished, and women used to be, undignified and violated in many ways. And then the Taliban phenomena came as a reaction to the practices of warlords. And,
yeah.
The issue is this, the U.S. media like to show the burqa, the thing that women wear in public, and symbolize that, and then say, oh, yeah, that's... women liberation and so, but women are not liberated. Their children, their husbands, their sons, daughters are being killed in bombing every day. In the current situation that we have is that they have concocted this election this year. On one hand, they have the Northern Alliance warlords who do not exist, would not exist for 1 week if U.S. forces leave. And on the other hand, somebody else, a former academic, and, there's been, because the past 13 years, they have been used to grabbing powers, swindling money, and utter corruption, and they could not tolerate somebody else coming to power. And that's why there's been this crisis, if you will. But the election doesn't mean anything when you have foreign forces in somebody's country. And of course, 60% of Afghanistan is still, suffer from war and destruction and whatnot. So it's one of those tragedies that persists for the past 35 years. Afghanistan has been suffering from this nightmare. First, the Russians were in, then, of course, this.
Meraki?
You
know, one thing we could do, I mean, if you don't mind, I'd like to dedicate this radio show to your father.
Thank you,
you
very
know,
much. You're
and
very
I think
kind.
It's extremely important. I mean, could you please explain for our listeners who your father was and why
sure.
you know so much, if you would, please?
Sure, sure. My father, his name was General Ghulam Siddiq Meraki. He was actually the founder of modern intelligence in Afghanistan, the intelligence service. He was one of the top students in Afghanistan Military University that he graduated along with a handful of others during the era of, Adenauer in Germany. They were sent to get educated in Germany in police and intelligence. So he studied about 6 years in Germany, and when he came back to Afghanistan in 1962, he actually formulated the organizational structure of the intelligence service in Afghanistan, and a modern, rational system was put in place. And then, of course, he was quite capable of what he had learned, and he was able to infiltrate many various organizations that were actually propped up by the Russians. And he also knew the time when the coup was taking place in 1978. But, of course, the Russians had placed agents in place. The information could not be reached to the president at that time. So when the coup came about, the communists came into power, and, of course, a year after 1979, the Russians invaded. My father was involved basically supporting the insurgency against the Russians' invasion, and he, after the, when we, the Russians realized that my father was actually not on their side, they wanted to assassinate him, and we ended up walking for 3-4 days to Pakistan to simply take our family and survive. And then when we went to Pakistan as refugees, my father formulated another intelligence agency, a small academy for the insurgents that were fighting against the Russians, and trained them in intelligence service. But then my father, by that, during the his stay before departure to Pakistan, that is in 1979, 80, and 81, in Afghanistan, he was in the Special Directorate of Intelligence, where information used to come through my father's office. And what he used to do was, whenever bombing used to take place, they would say XYZ location will be bombed, and my father would convey this information beforehand to the location, and people would evacuate in many places. So he has saved a lot of people from absolute death, and has been really regarded somebody who never took a dime when others became millionaire, and he always cared for the well-being of common people. And then when he came to Pakistan, since he was educated in Germany, he got political asylum in Germany, and thereafter came to the United States, since my father had an option to come to one of these places as being somebody of value and of Afghan society. And, throughout the years that he was here, he pushed us, my sister and I, to get educated. And of course, I earned my doctorate and 2 masters here, and my sister also got an MBA. My father was quite proud. But toward the end of his life in 2009, I told him that I'm going to Afghanistan. There was election in 2009. I'm going to become a candidate, but not because I believe in the election, but just to create a platform that I would show my opposition to all the travesties that are going on. He said, that's fine. Make sure you do not stay there, because it's not appropriate at this time to be part of the election, because what is going on, election doesn't mean anything. So I did that. When I came back, my father was quite proud, and he said, it's a good thing you did, that you raised your voice and showed your disagreement to the tragedy that's been going on in Afghanistan. And then just a month after my arrival back to, in Chicago, he had stomach cancer and as well as lungs cancer. You know, it was a devastating loss for my family and everyone, in the Afghan community. He was a very bright man. He was respected by everyone. The Russians respected him as an intellectual. The Americans, when we left Afghanistan, respected him a great deal. That's why he had the opportunity to come to the U.S. or Germany. And we were able to come there. And as an individual who never had his hand dirtied with somebody's blood or somebody's property or anything of such. So it's very difficult in an anarchic situation for somebody to keep himself clean and righteous. And so my father was a good man. He kept himself righteous and never colluded with anybody, and he always stood for the underdog in that society.
Yeah, so that's an incredible history. So, I mean, you've been able to be around and understand what's been happening from day one.
Yes, indeed. And it's been the issue is this, that what happened in Afghanistan was really, one of what I call it is really a consequence of the 1960s. You know, in the 1960s, in every society, you had, reactionary of one form or another emerged, and Afghanistan was no exception to that rule. And then to the 1970s, Marxist groups and also quote-unquote Islamic groups as an opposition to the Marxists emerged. And the Marxists, of course, did a coup in 1978 in Afghanistan. And then the result was insurgency of those Islamists that opposed them in the university when they both were, these two groups existed at the university level. And those insurgencies, of course, took the form when the U.S. and the West realized that the Cold War can be won in Afghanistan. They supported these Islamic groups that used to be university students back in the 1960s and 70s. And, of course, the history goes on. The Afghans defeated the Russians in Afghanistan, and then thereafter the U.S. government basically turned its back and walked away. And the Afghans told them, look, we were supposed to be allies. We have no economy, we have no government, we have nothing. You have to help us to stand on our feet, because after all, we defeated the Russians, the Cold War is over, you have $400 billion surplus, and so forth. And basically, the U.S. government was quite arrogant. It simply said, it's your problem, you fix it. That's why a lot of reactionary people came about and say, okay, what we did for the United States or the type of, payback we got was really dishonest and not, it was dreadful in many ways. And so when these individuals that came to power in 1992, the former insurgents, a handful of them were really, basically, there was no structure of government, there was no civility, and so the U.S. also withheld its interest because its interest was gone because the Russians were defeated, so the Afghans were disposable. And this fiefdoms and whatever came about, a lot of anarchy emerged, and then as a result of that, the Taliban, those were seminary students, they formed small groups and with the aim to bring about stability and security in Afghanistan, which they have. But then, of course, people say, oh, they were very strict. That's very true. They were very strict. They were very, very radical. But that's all we expected from them, because these seminary students were refugees, Afghan refugees that had lived in refugee camps in Pakistan, whose fathers were killed by the Russians. So when they came about, they never even knew their own homeland. They simply decided that our homeland, for which our fathers lost their lives, we want to bring stability there. And then when the U.S. invaded, the same young people that were brought up in refugee camps who had lost their fathers to the Russians war realized, oh, the Americans, they're killing us too. And so this mentality got formulated, and this reactionary, people become reactionary. They don't become reactionary overnight. They go through an experience, an experience in life that molds their opinion, and then you know, they resort to behavior that they out of sheer desperation. And so the past 13 years, the war that's been going on in Afghanistan, massive amount of uranium munitions been used, a lot of electromagnetic weapons that were being used, the microwave weapons, all type of weapons were used in Afghanistan basically as a testing ground by the U.S. and NATO forces. And a lot of Afghans, you know, high congenital deformities, cancer rates are quite high. And, you know, in terms of tangible results, there has hardly been any results. Of course, as a you know, there's been government structures formed, some degree of civility came about in the government. But unfortunately, the U.S. Made major mistake in 2001. They have installed the same warlords that brought anarchy in the 1990s into power. And those warlords are today in the same power they got used to, good life and making money and stealing public funds, and they're not letting it go. And that's why you have crisis at this time, quote-unquote election crisis in Afghanistan. So, you know, one of the things that the listeners need to understand is that money groups that exist and come about in different regions in that part of the world usually are propped up by intelligence services, mostly Western intelligence services, but through local governments such as Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and whatnot, in order to implement a certain agenda. And we see similar things, of course, today in Iraq and Syria and other places. We have groups that claim to be Islamic when, in fact, they have absolutely no regard whatsoever to Islam. They do not represent anything Islamic of any sort. And mostly what happens is that in all the Western countries, the country that specializes in formulating quote-unquote Islamic groups is the U.K., The U.K. intelligence service has specialty, and whenever a certain groups of the ISIS or whatever that you have in Iraq and Syria, they've been formulated and put in place with the direct and indirect assistance of the British through the Saudis. And what they do is, because this goes back to the rationale for that is the following, that they create a crisis. Within the crisis, they create, of course, discontent come about. People are unhappy. And in response to the unhappiness, they form a group that supposedly advocates the rights of those that are unhappy. And that they do indirectly. And then the idea of these various groups, of this anarchy that's been going on in the Middle East currently, is to restructure the region. Because this is the reminiscent of World War One, post-World War One and World War Two, when they draw borders arbitrarily, you know, back in the 1900s.
So that was back at that time. That was, I mean, most famous, Lawrence of Arabia with the Sykes-Picot Treaty,
right,
between
right.
the British and French, that decided where all these nations would be, who's going to lead them. And what it was the British and French setting up for control then totally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the what happened was that they installed, for example, the Arabian Peninsula was allocated to an individual by the name Saud, and it's been named after his family, Saudi Arabia. Different countries, Transjordania used to be called, became Jordan, and Iraq became another entity. They took the courts and divided into a bunch of pieces and stuck them to each country that's in the region. So these countries never have their own stability. You know, divide and rule was the principle. The same thing, of course, the Assyrian people were also dispersed because they had a history there. And the entire region, you know, there are certain, you know, the certain time comes in the, you know, course of civilization that people get an understanding, realize that they've been used and abused, and they want to rethink how they behave. And in response to their local rethinking, the same intelligence service that they did what they did in the past, in the 19th, 20th century, they created the current mess. So the opinion or the views of people deviate from their own historical crisis and concentrate on what is going on now. And they utilize the current situation in order to restructure the region. Because this is post, New World Order, I call it, a post-New World Order situation. Because the New World Order that was announced by Senior Bush in 1991, that actually started to lose its quote-unquote juice. Because regional powers came about, Russia, China, and others, and they have to create some other situation in order to justify their mode of behavior. For example, September 11, Wolfowitz said a very famous phrase. He said there will be a perpetual war, and we need to have post 1992 Cheney doctrine was to make sure another superpower doesn't come about, but also for the identity of the West, there needs to be another unseen or some sort of enemy. In the past, it used to be the Soviet Union and the Cold War and the Communist bloc. With this coming about, collapsed and their demise was brought about by the Afghan War, they needed another enemy, some boogeyman, if you will. And as a result, what happens is that they have created these various groups indirectly and directly in order to create crisis. In response to crisis, they formulate policies so they can restructure. And the restructuring is basically done to monopolize natural resources. And that's one of the aspects of the doctrine of post-1992 Chinese doctrine was that for us, in order to prevent the emergence of another superpower and or delaying the emergence of another superpower, we need to monopolize energy sources all over the world. And currently, the U.S. has more military forces all over the world than the British had in the 19th century. And so that is why there's been this sustained campaign to make sure directly or indirectly monopolize global natural resources. For example, in Afghanistan, there are natural resources estimated between $2 to $3 trillion. And those natural resources are rare metals such as lithium and others that are used in specialized industries, including gas, petroleum, and whatnot. All of them, that's a significant investment. And significant investment, significant resources that once monopolized would result into the deprivation of other local powers or global powers, emerging global powers such as China and, or barely sustaining Russia. So that's one of these things that are going on in the region.
Now, one of the things that, again, when I first started studying this and we started planning military operations in Afghanistan, the thing, and you and I have looked at this and we've discussed it before, There was a discussion in the U.S. House of Representatives on February 12th of 1998. Mm-hmm. And what this dealt with was a company called Unocal.
True.
That wanted to establish a pipeline that's going to come out of the inner Soviet republics where all that oil is, down through Afghanistan up against the Iranian border because of the ability to build a pipeline there because of the height of the mountains and everything, and then down through Pakistan on out. So you had the one coming south, and then the other one, the pipeline coming out of the same region, is going east or going back to the west, which is, again, what's led into all this nightmare that's going on right now in those inter-Soviet republics also.
True. And what happened was that in that year, the Unocal Corporation wanted to build a pipeline from Turkmenistan, the former Soviet Republic, through Afghanistan to Pakistan, and, of course, then extending to India even in the future. And Unocal Corporation actually wanted to pull a fast one on the Taliban's government. They offered the Taliban government only $50 million as a transit fee, when in fact should have been either $500 million to $1 billion a year. And once the Taliban realized that these people are stealing from us, they are lying to us, they gave that contract for the construction of the pipeline to the Argentinian company called Bridas. And once that was given, then they, if you remember, the Argentinian economy started to collapse. And that pipeline issue and energy issue was entirely kept away from any other company other than the current the Unocal Corporation, which was, of course, Dick Cheney's company. He was its CEO. He was a major factor in there. And so, the idea was to build this, and people in Afghanistan were happy they would benefit from it. But of course, not at the cost of of them being deprived of the resources that they should have initially obtained. And so that was one factor. And that culminated to the point that people that they decided, say, okay, they brought it, at that time the government of Taliban, they brought their officials to Berlin, Germany, and told them, it's your choice, either you accept the carpet of gold or accept a carpet of bombs, referring to the pipeline.
Now, I'd like to read a direct quote, and I'm quoting this directly out of the congressional transcript. Quote, last October, the Central Asia Gas Pipeline Consortium, called CentGas, in which Unocal owns an interest, was formed to develop a gas pipeline which would link Turkmenistan's vast Dadabad gas field with the markets in Pakistan and possibly India. The proposed 790-mile pipeline will open up new markets for gas, traveling from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan to Multan and Pakistan. Proposed extension would move gas on to New Delhi, where it connect with the existing pipeline. As with the proposed Central Asia oil pipeline, CentGas cannot begin construction until an internationally recognized Afghanistan government is in place.
Mm-hmm.
End quote. So that, from what I knew in the military, is what triggered it all.
Yes.
Now,
the government in place.
Yeah, so the question I have now, and this is the thing that I think everybody wonders, what government should be in place in Afghanistan? What do the people that live there perceive as an existing in Afghanistan? And I guess, the U.S. always looks as who has what allegiance to who,
Right.
But that doesn't come into play, does it?
No, actually, what happens is in Afghanistan, the ethnic composition of the country is as follows. The Afghan or the Pashtun constitute about 67% of the population, 65 to 67% of the population. The remaining are Tajiks, Uzbeks, and various other minorities. And in 1992, when these minorities took over the government, and there was a fight between the various insurgents groups, and those insurgents groups that were actually minorities, they got support even though when the Russians departed, they needed, basically the sociology of Eastern and Western imperialism, quote unquote, that you invest in minorities in order to do your bidding in a country. And that's exactly what they did. And what they did was, when they took over the government, they sent off official letters to all these global institutions, wherein they said the Pashtuns constitute only 38% of the population. Up to that time, the CIA even had in its book of world records, world facts, Pashtuns as 50%. When this letter came to them, they lowered it to 42% or 40%. So as a result of this the conspiracy, they made sure to have these Northern Alliance thugs and a handful of, basically who are non-Pashtuns, have them in power. And based on this fraudulent statistics, they wanted to do their policy bidding. In Afghanistan, the Pashtun population, they talk about democracy. In Pashtun culture, we have a code of honor and a way of life that we call, that it's called local democracy. Whatever happens and transpires, whatever occurs at the village level, at the family level, at the tribal level, at the province level, is done through jirga. Jirga meaning basic assembly or council. People get together. If there's a conflict, a representative is chosen, a handful of representatives, and they take responsibility from both sides, and they decide, and then both sides have to abide by it. So Pashtuns were not falling into the issue of democracy, but they wanted, they still do, a normal government that is not affiliated with anybody, but that could simply concentrate on the stability in Afghanistan, a normal life, a normal sustenance for its population, education for their children, health care, and modernization and development. That's what they want. And also, there is this religious belief every society has its own. Afghanistan happens to be a Muslim country, and they want everything to be within the confinements or boundaries of their religious belief system. And, Afghans were never really radical ever, unless the seeds of radicalism had been, cultivated in, as a result of the war against Russians, and that was totally advocated by the United States. In fact, the books for the refugee children that were radicalized in Pakistan were being printed by the University of Nebraska, and they were being shipped to the refugee camps where children would learn that they have to do jihad, they have to do this, they have to do that. That mentality was actually instilled into the refugee population, their youngsters, by these books that was provided by the United States government. And so, and then of course, events have to happen, and events, interact with mindset, and as a result, a different kind of mindset is instituted, a different population emerges, especially the youngsters. But at this time, the people are well aware, and what they want is the past 13 years has been a sustained war against the Pashtun people. You see, the Pashtun nation that constitute about 70 million people, that includes the population in Afghanistan as well as in northwest and northwest area of Pakistan. This population is the only population that really has an egalitarian way of life, and one entity that is quite different from any other group of people in the world, and that they never really submitted to foreign forces. And they realize, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote this, this treatise saying that for any superpower to remain superpower, it has to dominate Euro-Asia area. Euro-Asia constituted basically from Afghanistan all the way to Europe. And this region, basically the domination of this region would not be possible without the inclusion, without the submission of Afghanistan. They realized that they could go to a region and they could really penetrate it, but Afghanistan, the Pashtun population, would never welcome foreigners with guns. Foreigners are always welcome to their households when they come as guests. And, that's part of our nature that guests are valued respected and taken care of. But when somebody comes with guns and shoots at them, there's another principle, it's called revenge. If you shoot the person of a family, the entire village come after you. If you hit the village, the entire tribe come after you. If you hit the tribe, the entire region comes after you. And that is the mentality the U.S. military never understood. Why was this? Because their advisor was a chef from a kebab house in Nebraska. There was a chef from the who had a restaurant in Nebraska, who ended up becoming the advisor to General McChrystal in Petraeus. When somebody's advisor is a chef who doesn't know who actually has a preconceived notion, prejudice against the population there, and just want to fill his own pockets, and that's what happens to the policy of the United States. being molded by an individual who is really was good in making kebab, rather than becoming an advisor in policy formulation or ethnic issues or dynamics of the region. I, for one, tried in vain so many times and contacted Department of State and others that I, as an Afghan American, I like to contribute to the stability of the region, and as a mediator, as somebody who can utilize his knowledge of the region and dynamics and nuances that are really endemic to the each region and its people, I could be a great service to people on both ends, to Afghans as well as Americans.
Now, your PhD, what you studied, is economic development of Afghanistan, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. My dissertation was Factors of Underdevelopment in Afghanistan, 1919 to 2000. And in fact, all my education I tailored for Afghanistan, because it's like in the United States, you know, when somebody comes from a neighborhood that was really downtrodden and under a bad situation, and the person become wealthy, goes back to his neighborhood, try to help out. I subscribe to the same notion that, you know, by being educated in the United States, I benefit from this society. I like to help out to the poor people there, too. And this way I can be, create a bridge between two societies. And I have tried in the previous administration in vain, in this administration. In fact, James Dobbins is Obama's special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan. He has a senior advisor by the name of Barnett Rubin, who is a professor in New York. He left his job and came back to New York, and I realized, that, look, this is a good opportunity for me to occupy that position. I applied for it, and they simply flatly rejected. They also realized that Barnett Rubin used to take advice from me. Then he used to convey the advice to James Dobbins, who in turn conveyed the advice to Obama.
Now,
I was the source.
The big question that everybody has in word is concerns with the military. Obviously, the U.S. military, and you've studied in this, and I know you've been involved because you've helped me trying to get medical care for everybody.
Sure.
The significant problem we have now is the military operations on all sides is creating an incredible number of casualties.
True.
There is totally inadequate medical care for anybody, whether it's the U.S. military or whether it's for the, we'll call it so-called Afghan allies, or the, what I'm not sure how even would describe this, those that are allied
True.
With the U.S. military.
Right, right.
And then the incredible number of casualties that we have within the civilian population.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you wrote the treatise, one of the, an important book on this, didn't you?
Yes, yes. This was a book that I wrote. You know, I lost, you know, people used to, they asked me, so, well, why weren't you working for the past 15 years? I said, look, I was teaching up to 2001. You know, my nature is I'm a humanist and a pacifist. I like to help and be part of something constructive. So I went and became volunteer to help out in the midst of war and destruction and whatnot. And you know, when you open your mouth and, you know, of course, express your opinion, you're being branded, you know, under one name or another, unfortunately. And so what happens is this issue of civilian casualty as well as military, civilians are, of course, in the thousands and hundreds of thousands that are maimed permanently, that have become a large percentage of society in Afghanistan that create its within the society another sub-society, if you will, because they constitute, you know, millions of people, basically, not hundreds of thousands, millions, from the previous war as well as the current war. Equally, there is, of course, they didn't institute any adequate infrastructure. You see, billions, more than $600 billion supposedly is spent in Afghanistan. And that $600 billion, a minute percentage of that is spent on infrastructure and development. The remaining went to military operations. And as a result of that, you have no medical care, you have no infrastructure, whomever gets maimed, injured, the lucky ones are those that somehow survive, and the remaining will die. Even the so-called Afghan military, you see, there's so much corruption. Soldiers that are wounded are taken to the hospitals in Kabul and so forth, and the administrators, they steal the money for the medication and others because they have former warlords in place. And the money soldiers, they end up, their legs and arms and so forth that are injured turn into gangrene, you know. They have worms in their body, and as a result they expire, they die. Equally, of course, in the case of the U.S. Soldiers, that they come from a war, any war, back to the U.S., and then they say, okay, they just give him a pat on the back and say, okay, get lost. And of course, you're intimately involved in this. Bunch of young men and women started committing suicide because they didn't get adequate health care, and many of them would wait for months to even get evaluated. But it begs the question that how come billions of dollars are utilized in destroying places, and when it comes to the recovery, you have nothing. The same people that you're using to supposedly kill other people with it, you come and you treat them as disposable. The simple, few sentences answer to that would be, wars are done basically to nourish the bankers, the multinational corporations.
You know, one of the things, a brand new story today, and we need to refer everybody to it. There's a brand new story on September 10th. We're recording this today on Wednesday, September 10th. The new story on Army Times survey, 40% of wounded face problems getting VA care. So the stories keep getting worse and worse and worse by the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the medical care is broken. The environmental remediation is broken. I mean, you and I have been intimately involved. We've spoken all over the world together trying to, at the United Nations, working with everybody trying to get the environment cleaned up so that it can be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
unless the environment is cleaned up, the ability for agricultural production is going to be limited.
Mm-hmm.
The availability of safe water is going to be virtually non-existent.
Absolutely.
And then the air is contaminated, so you have a nightmare all the way around.
Totally.
What do you see or what do you perceive? I mean, the U.S. goes over there, or whatever they call it, the international forces, whatever, at IF. Are they welcome? Do you think that the general Afghan population is welcoming them, or do you think the general Afghan population wants them to leave, or how is the feeling?
They oppose them. They want them to leave. You see, there was a unit from Washington State that was a large military unit. The entire unit had a very sick mentality. They would kill civilians. And this, they have been prosecuted, and I don't know what happened to the prosecution, but they would kill civilians, and then what would happen is they would cut a body part, a finger, a head, an arm, or whatever, as a souvenir. In fact, there were cases when they used to play cards, and they ran out of money and say, okay, I have an Afghan finger to pitch in. And so this is the type of massive crimes they have committed there. They attack people's houses. They shoot first. They kill people and they ask questions later. Then, there are many, many such cases when they went there and shot people and they realized it was just utter mistake and then ended up giving $90 per life to the people that they killed.
You're not coming from this from sitting outside. You've actually been in Afghanistan,
village by
you've
village.
Studied it, you've seen what's happening firsthand, correct?
I went village by village. I have even, videos online on YouTube of my trips, a few of my trips, but I have many trips I have done. I have interviewed victims' families. I have sat with them. If you remember when the supposedly lone soldiers that went there and killed 19 people or whatever people in Panjwayi district of Kandahar, I went there and investigated that too. There was no lone soldier. They simply, have him as a fall guy. This was done by three groups, each group composing between 15 and 20 people. They got pissed because one of their Humvee was blown by the insurgents, and they, as a result, went there house by house, killed people, and then they burned their bodies. And so one soldier could never do that. And in fact, I spoke to the relatives of those that were killed, witnesses that existed, and they were hiding, trying to avoid being killed. These units came, and helicopter was on top to make sure that they do basically teach a lesson to the local population. They mass murdered the people, created massacres, and like we did in Vietnam and so forth. And then they walk away, and they have this one soldier with they drugged him or whatever. They said, okay, this person did it, and even Karzai, who is a puppet of the foreign forces, came out. He said, I don't accept this nonsense. This was done by groups of soldiers, and why you're hiding the truth? And so what happens is that, there are 12,000 villages destroyed in Afghanistan. In these villages, you have people. And in these people, they have their utter hatred toward foreign forces, because foreign forces are there simply to kill them. And then what happens is they call it democracy, quote-unquote liberation. And then you got TV channels such as Fox News and so forth that glorify nightmares overseas. But the truth of the matter is that people over there are fed up with this, and they realize that they have to fight for their right. And whether they turn into Taliban, go to Taliban or some other groups, they do it from, do it of utter desperation, because those groups are vehicle of their revenge. Through them, they can fight for what they have lost: father, mother, son, daughter, whatnot, entire families. And they have, money, women, they give birth to deformed children, and all of them are horrified, saying that we never had anything like this before the 2001 invasion. What's going on? They do realize that this was done, basically some illegal weapons were being used, uranium and others, as you know. And so people over there, they do not want U.S. forces or any other forces. Yes, they say if you wanted to help us, you should have done it for the past 13 years instead of bombing us. If you used that money building infrastructure, you would have seen no insurgent. There would be nobody taking guns fighting you. People would be welcoming you. Instead, billions of dollars made sure to nourish the military-industrial complex so they could sell more weapons to the U.S. government and overseas, and basically revitalized the military-industrial complex. But as a result, of course, the people of this country, U.S., are no longer safe. The people overseas are no longer safe. And this whole notion that we wanted to fight terrorism is like fighting common flu. You can't fight terrorism unless you have the reason for terrorism eradicated. You have tyrants in places, or you invade places, or you bomb people, or you bring them like animals. I mean, think about it. They brought an 11-year-old kid to Guantanamo Bay, kept them in cages for 5 years. What kind of beast would do this? And then after 5 years, and this kid was being released, you expect that kid to go home and sleep? If I were that kid, I would take gun too. If somebody keeps me in cage for 5 years, and they had a 100-year-old man who could not even see. Why they brought these people? Because when the U.S. invaded, Karzai announced that, look, anybody that put their arms down, forget it, this war is over, and get it over with. Instead, the U.S. told the Northern Alliance folks that anybody who could give us, quote-unquote, a Taliban or Taliban sympathizer will give them $5,000. And as a result, the Northern Alliance gave them all these Pashtun people, regular villagers, peasants. They brought them, treat them like animals, torture them, And some of them, they would have music on their ears with earphones on them, and the music would be so loud, they would be chained to the floor, and for 48 hours, they would leave them like this. They would defecate in their pants, they would make a mess, and they would totally distorted and would be in a congregation and perception would not even exist. And that's the kind of tortures they committed in Guantanamo Bay and other similar prisons inside Afghanistan.
So one of the things that comes down, you know, we keep hearing the thing insurgent or militant, as if it's some foreign group or some foreign entity that's come in. But if what you're describing, in a sense, it's the individuals that live in this region, that live in these areas, that are fed up with everything, and they're fed up with anybody coming in there and trying to tell them what to do or how to do it.
Let me give you a simple example. You know, we have in this country, we have militia groups.
That, yeah, they're dangerous.
Yeah, you know, some have, you know, there are various groups that, you know, civil societies and others, depends on their grievances. As some would say, we protect the Constitution, others say we don't like this, we like that, and so forth. In Afghanistan, what they have done is they have killed people, and people simply fed up, and they took up arms against a foreign force. These people that they call insurgents or militants or whatnot, they didn't come from the moon or the Mars or any other country. They are local people. And what happens is they have created these media outlets. I mean, think about it. The poorest country in the world, in Afghanistan, used to have one TV station. Now it has 32 TV stations. Why? Because these 32 TV stations get their money from Western embassies, and they are their mouthpieces. And then tell the people, and this falsehood is being really concocted, saying that, oh, well, you know, these insurgents being supported by Pakistan and so forth and so on, and without them, they would not exist. They don't seem to realize that Pakistan had more support towards Mujahideen when they're fighting against the Russians. 10% of that support went to Taliban at this time. But the foreign support was so important because they would control every inch of Afghanistan. After all, 45 countries are standing behind them, including U.S. and NATO. But no, there is no foreign involvement. It's local population who are fed up, and they're fighting against foreign occupation. You know, if you're here in Illinois and in Chicago, and we had, let's say, Mexico or some other place invade here, or some other country from nowhere, you know, I bet my last dime people would say, no, we do not accept it. We're not, we're not going to go with it. And so that's the type of, the corporate media is in cahoots with the military-industrial complex. They're criminally liable, because they lie and they cover the truth, and they facilitate, mold people's opinion in a falsehood that is really part of the policy of the government that allows directs the media to do what they want them to do. And as a result, what happened, people will go along with whatever new policy is formulated by the cabal, if you will.
And so right now we're looking at, you know, we've only got about a few minutes left here. Before the end of the show, we'd have to do, continue on. There's so much here that to learn and understand. Right now, what type of government would the Afghans, or for the most part, the Iraqis or the Syrians, I mean, it's all this stuff is tied together. What type of governments would they want the actual people that live there installed, and how would it operate? I mean,
You know, before these wars, there, for example, in Iraq, there was a normal government. Of course, it wasn't perfect. It had its own mistakes. It had also various tragedies. But Iraq was one country. It had a revenue. It has a normalcy like any other civil place. Syria, the same thing. But what happens is they created these nightmares. The population over there, populations are not given any chance to choose for themselves. In fact, people are told what they should do, should want, and what they should have, and so forth. Otherwise, people over there, they are not interested in anything that they want others to, you know, prescribe and tell them that they should have. They basically want a normal government, democratic or otherwise. That's not, that's, you know, they don't have the luxury of democracy. What they want is their basic needs covered. People are there dying of hunger, disease, and other, you know, factors. And for them, the most important thing is for their kids not to die. They don't care if the government is one extreme or another. To them, stability, security, and dignity is a prerequisite for existence. And that is not possible when you have anarchy and when you have wars going on. And whomever can provide these stabilities, these normalcies, they are welcome there. But of course, those who are interested, you know, in money and trying to fill their pockets and hungry for power, they're not interested to provide anything but simply to have the stick and muddy the water and grab the fish. And that's what their entire exercise has been for the past many, many years.
What would you suggest or recommend to President Obama if you were to able to sit down with him one-on-one? I mean, in the last four or five minutes here, what would you suggest or recommend him from your insight and your ideas and your thoughts and the people you've talked to? What recommendations would you give to him?
My main and major recommendation would be the following. Let me formulate a group of Afghan elders and academics. Let me go inside Afghanistan, facilitate negotiation, and we want the foreign forces entirely out. If you want to have some forces for training, you can have them, but that has to be agreed upon. And the only way a problem can be resolved is through negotiation and talking. And when bullets are flying, nothing could be done, one. Secondly, you need to include the majority population. This war against the majority population has to end. The ostracizing and targeting the Pashtun people simply will continue the anarchy, and they will fight against you, fight against anyone that sides with you. And so stop the animosity toward the Pashtun people, stop their genocide. And thirdly, if you want a stable Afghanistan, that would be an ally of the United States and a friend. And of course, the Afghan people realize that the common people in the United States are exactly like them, regular folks. You know, if you want stable Afghanistan, help them in their development. Afghanistan has massive natural resources. Help them excavate it, and they should be able to pay for their own existence and subsistence. And so these are three factors. And please, the other thing is this. Those, suited individuals with suits and a few courses that I have done at the universities and quote-unquote called experts and flooded the State Department, they're not going to do you any good.
Well, Mohammed, we're running out of time here. I'd like to thank you very much. We'd like to continue this conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, the Progressive Radio Network, again, education and knowledge. Thank you, Mohammed, and God bless you and everything else for all you've done, sir. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.